nation, he thought. This will never work, not with a minder at my side. He had no choice now, so they both walked to the kiosk. No sign of the junior CIA officer. No sign of any American. And now, with a security goon at hand, even if the CIA officer showed, he would abort contact. This desperate plan was too absurd, just like his life. The minder smoked, looking around the old, tired neighborhood. He was fat and not very smart, but loyal to the brutal system he served. The code clerk paid for the items. As he turned away from the counter, a stocky, plain-looking, drably dressed woman brushed against him. He felt her shove something into his pocket. He was stunned, but had the sense to keep moving. The minder was only 10 feet away, bored and oblivious to the woman's presence. The CIA had responded. He had money in his pocket to replenish the funds he had stolen. He also knew there would be instructions. He never met the junior CIA officer who had retrieved his message. He never again saw the woman, one of the agency's best. He never met face to face with any other CIA officer in that country. Yet he spied for years, delivering breathtaking intelligence and unprecedented access to communication systems for small amounts of cash and huge deposits in a secret escrow account. With his own brilliance, his own knowledge, and the written guidance of the CIA, he mastered the use of dead drops and other covert communications techniques. He was one of the CIA's most prolific and valued agents, and he was never caught. Ego. The tall, skinny man processed the paperwork slowly. He aligned the three copies, with two blue ink-print sheets layered in the middle, and smoothed them with his palms. Then he began to write. He crafted block letters, line after line, using a cracked, clear plastic ballpoint pen. The pen and the government form claimed all his attention. He squinted through his black frame glasses, his forehead wrinkled with concentration. The wobbly ceiling fan thunked overhead, pushing hot, humid air around the dim little office. A calendar with a photo featuring some heavy earth-moving equipment hanging from a nail on the wall behind him had the previous day's dates crossed out. The X marks over the numbers looked nearly perfect. I wondered if he used a ruler. An open box of paper clips, a stained stamp pad, and two worn rubber stamps were spaced apart evenly on one side of the desk. There was nothing else. No photos, no signs of his personal life. He was just a clerk at his desk, working silently. I waited and watched. With quiet solemnity, he handed me my copy. I read the details. He had it all correct. I said so and thanked him. He nodded once. He clasped his hands. He held his head a bit higher. His thin neck stuck out of the collar of the worn white shirt. The shirt and thin tie sagged over the erect, scrawny torso. "If I have any questions, may I call you?" I asked. "Yes, please," he responded evenly. No enthusiasm, no friendliness. But he was not unfriendly either. He did not have a business card, so he wrote his phone number on an index card that I provided. 2 weeks later, I called him with a bureaucratic issue as a pretext. He agreed to meet to resolve the matter. We quickly moved to other topics, including geopolitics and his personal life. He was a government functionary with no wife, no girlfriend. He did not have a college degree, but he read constantly. He asked questions about the United States. He had never visited, but wanted to see New York and Los Angeles. He had seen these great urban sights on TV. His boss was fair but very busy. He had no future professional plans. He claimed he enjoyed his work, although it was very simple. After several low-key meetings, he began providing information. At first, there was nothing too sensitive. After he gained confidence, he started taking more risks, even citing classified papers that he read. I provided him a couple of modest gifts, including a simple, cheap pen and pencil set. He would have trouble explaining anything expensive. Eventually, I passed him envelopes with small amounts of cash. Soon thereafter, he reciprocated by delivering classified documents. I never pitched him, never had to. The operational relationship just evolved. Money and ideology mattered, but more than anything, this agent wanted somebody to listen. With only a basic education and no family connections, his chances of promotion were near nil. He was a clerk, a very smart, underappreciated clerk. He knew that, and he wanted more. He wanted to contribute to something for somebody. He did not hide this need. He said so, plainly and clearly. He also admired the United States, but that seemed secondary. More than anything, he craved a meaningful mission. About a year after his recruitment, in a rolling car meeting, he gave me a sheaf of papers inside a manila folder tied with a string. He said the file was important, but did not elaborate. We had other issues to discuss and not much time. I wanted to keep our meetings to less than 15 minutes. After dropping him, running a surveillance detection route, swapping cars, running another route, and eventually returning home, I read the papers while sitting at my dining room table. "Oh, good Lord," I muttered. I read the papers again. Within 48 hours, the verbatim text of the documents was in the hands of the President of the United States, who asked his briefer about the origins of the report. The briefer responded that a clandestine human source, a foreign agent, was responsible. The briefer could not offer the president any more than that, because the briefer did not know the identity of the agent. The president thanked the briefer, and also directed that the unidentified agent be thanked. The briefer passed along the message to the clandestine service desk responsible for the operation. The HQS desk informed me the next day via encrypted cable. 2 weeks later, at the next scheduled meeting with my agent, I passed along the president's thanks. We were in another rolling car meeting, so I could not see his response. But I heard his voice falter as he asked, "Did the president read the papers?" "Yes, the president himself," I said. You're telling me that the President of the United States read the papers?" "Yes," I assured him again. "I did not know that such a thing could happen. Does he know about me?" he asked. "He does not know your identity or anything about you, except that you work for U.S. intelligence and we depend upon you." The car hit a couple of potholes. The rain started to fall again. The wipers pushed the water, but not fast enough. I had trouble seeing. "Yes, you can depend upon me. The president can depend upon me." "We will. I'm proud to be working with you," I said. "Yes, we will work together. This is important," the agent said. We rolled and bounced through the tropical downpour with nothing more to say. We listened to the pounding rain on cheap metal and the thwack-thwack of the rubber wipers as I made my way to the agent's drop-off point. We normally did not waste time shaking hands at the drop-off, but this time we did. I gave him an envelope with a modest bonus. "Thank you," the agent said. I knew that he was more grateful for the mission than the money. That is what he meant. I nodded, but he had already exited the car. He walked away through the pounding sheets of water into the black African night, down the muddy alley to another road where he hoped to catch a taxi. Mice/RC. Each of the recruitments I made or supervised was different. They ran the gamut of motivational factors, unending, shifting combinations of money, ideology, compromise, and ego. Mice. Years later in Afghanistan, revenge and coercion, RC, would be key ingredients in recruitment operations. I learned that any specific mice-RC spectrum could never be replicated. Each act was unique. No recruitment operation ever evolved exactly as envisioned,